is your smart home talking to, and what is it saying? Funny things you can find on the dark web, a review of the Galaxy S9, and an Airbnb for hunters. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 22, recorded Thursday, March 8th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to the show, Tech News Weekly. This is where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. Happy International Women's Day, Jason.
Absolutely. Big day.
Mm-hmm.
Good day. You know how I celebrate?
How?
I do a podcast with you.
Yeah. A podcast with a lady on it.
Is that... I feel like I should probably do more than just that, right? Because, like, we do this every week.
No, but... you live International Women's Day. You're a great dad, a great co-host, and yeah.
What? Why are you talking me up? This is all about you. You're awesome. Yeah. You're the awesome co-host, and I'm honored to do a show with you week in and week out.
That's sweet. Should we talk?
I think we should get into the news, because that's what we do here. Last month, Kashmir Hill from Gizmodo posted a story that recounted the lengths through which she went to smartify your home, if that is a word, and all of the details that those smart home devices tracked and logged as a result. I thought it was a very eye-opening piece, very apropos to today's trend towards increasingly smart homes. Gizmodo's Surya Matu was the person that actually received all that leaking smart home data during Kashmir's experience, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you on today to talk about this. So let's jump into the weeds here. First, you were the one who Kashmir trusted. So it's a big line of trust there to receive all of these distinct pieces of data, which can be very revealing place to be. Talk a little bit about her experiment and why she entrusted you in particular with that data.
Well, Kashmir and I worked together and we came up with this story idea, I think, over the summer. And basically, the whole premise was that we wanted to test what it feels like to live in a smart home. We weren't really interested in all the data that goes through. Like, we don't want to break the encryption on her devices, but we just want to get a sense of, like, how chatty are our homes. So I think she trusted me because, one, she knows where I live and works with me every day. I think she was also just really curious.
Yeah.
And didn't read from the sounds. I only found this out later, but I don't think she, like, fully explained to her family what she was going to do when she started the experiment.
Yeah, she really had to kind of stock up her home with all of these devices. Prior to this, did she have very many smart home devices operating in her home, or did she really just stock it up specifically because of this experiment?
Yeah, so she had an Echo. She had, I think the main one she had was an Echo. She might have had a couple, and she didn't have a Roomba yet. The Roomba came after. I think the main thing she had was a Skylar. Yeah, the Amazon Skylar, but nothing else.
Which is, I mean, the starting point for a lot of people right now. I think I read a report just the other day that 20% of American households, according to a report, have some sort of a smart voice assistant, home assistant. There. So, I mean, the IoT, you know, smart home battle is on. It's certainly the homes are geared up for this sort of stuff. So you captured a lot of this data, this information flowing in from all of these distinct points throughout Kashmir's home. What did that tell you about Kashmir, you and Kashmir both? What did that tell you about her smart home life in particular?
Well, the first thing it kind of showed us was that these devices sort of have a life of their own, and they don't only communicate with their servers when you are interacting with them. So like, I think since from when we started the collection, just started collecting the data, there wasn't a single hour, which for a period of 2 months, where there was no data being sent from the house to the internet. which kind of surprised us. It's also kind of interesting to see the sort of different like choices, like the design choices being made by different companies around this stuff. So like the first example pings its servers every 3 minutes, but the Roomba only does it like twice a day. And just the way these kind of signals, these ambient emissions of data were going through her house, let me kind of get a sense of what was happening in it, even though I couldn't see it directly in the data. So like I knew when her daughter was waking up because there was suddenly more like Alexa activity. She would like play this app on the other side that had like background noise, that like a white noise, which allowed her daughter to sleep. So there were just those kind of signals that were coming up. Even though I didn't know exactly what was happening, I got a sense of what the house might be doing.
Wow. So these were more ambient signals. It wasn't actual information that you were getting. Like you didn't see pictures, or you could just see things like what time they were waking up.
So yeah. So the way to think about it is the way we were collecting data is you can imagine me to have been like the receptionist of her house, where every package that was coming and going, I was making a note of. And if it was a sealed envelope, I would only see the address, so like where it's going to and where it's coming from. And if it was like a postcard, like an unencrypted packet, then I'd get the whole thing. So for example, her smart TV, turns out Hulu sends a lot of its information unencrypted. So we actually knew like when her family was watching Hulu and what they would watch. So I knew they watched like Difficult People. Yeah, you got a graph there. They watch a lot of Difficult People. And I also know like they were home on New Year's because the TV was really active around that time. I think this is Christmas. Yep. Mm-hmm. They had Christmas on the whole day. And then New Year's, yeah, we could see that. We knew that. I was like, hey, were you home this New Year's? And she's like, yeah, how do you know? She's like, oh, your TV was like letting me know.
So you know so much as when they're home, and you can presume when they're not home if Hulu's not doing anything.
Right. And you can actually, so there was like a 10-day period when they weren't home and the data is like flat like this. And you're like, oh, nothing is happening. Everything is staying exactly the same. So it looks like no one's actually using this house.
Talk a little bit about the encrypted versus unencrypted. I'm curious to know, of all of these different devices sending information, you know, be it, you know, inconsequential or actually, you know, very descriptive of what someone might be doing. Like, I would imagine that like we hear about IoT and insecurity all the time. I mean, it really should all be encrypted to some degree, right? What was your kind of view on how much of that traffic was encrypted?
So most of it was encrypted, which is what we were expecting everything to be encrypted, to be honest. We were really surprised when we got this Hulu information being sent unencrypted, because especially considering Hulu is encrypted on the browser. Mm-hmm. So we were just surprised. But I think that was one of the things we were curious in testing, is like how... when it's with a lot of these devices, they're made, which we bought devices that were cheap and expensive, just to see how they kind of went across like a spectrum of like price, or how the quality went down. And that was definitely something we noticed, where cheaper devices, excuse me, things that were coming like that we were buying for like $10 or $15 had more unencrypted information. But really, like we weren't doing that. We were just kind of curious what Comcast, Cash's ISP could see. That's one of the reasons we did this experiment. Mm-hmm. Because all of this information, based on the way the laws have changed in the last year, ISPs can now sell. So we were just curious, like, what would, even if everything's encrypted, this was the question we really started with. Even if everything's encrypted, what can we tell about a smart home from the perspective of like an ISP, and what could they sell from that?
So, wow, this is amazing. You didn't use a bunch of really complicated equipment to do this kind of research. I mean, you used a Raspberry Pi, right?
That's right, yep.
Just tell us your setup. Explain a little bit about I know it's a complicated and involves a lot of steps and people who are familiar with the command line, et cetera, but what can you tell us about the setup?
I mean, basically what it was a Raspberry Pi is a computer that has a Wi-Fi card and an Ethernet card. So we connected the Ethernet card of the Raspberry Pi to the router that she already had in her home. So that's how this device got the internet from the regular connection coming to the house. And then the Wi-Fi card on this Raspberry Pi basically acted like a router. So it would spit out, like there was like a name to the network. You can configure all of this in the post we wrote. It talks about how to do it. But basically, yeah, you just make a network name, spit it up, and all Cash had to do was connect those devices she wanted to investigate to that network. And there was a program running on the router, which is the Raspberry Pi, that collected all this information and sent it to me.
Yeah, and so it collected that data. Then you were tasked with actually taking a look at that raw data after the fact to kind of analyze it. I'm sure you have some software to kind of put that through. What was that process like, taking a look at the data after the fact?
So originally when we started this, I didn't look at the data for the first month. I just wanted to like collect enough stuff before I started poking around. And I quickly realized that I didn't really need to do any like deep analysis on it. What was more helpful was to be able to see the data in real time. So I built us an interface that allowed us to kind of like on a dashboard, see the traffic as it was coming in, because it allowed Cash and me to like run experiments like in the house to see what that looked like in the data. So like, for example, we found out her smart toothbrush would send data every time she was brushing her teeth, because there was a small period of time where I asked Cash to log everything she was doing. So I could compare it to the data to see if I could find some patterns. And that's how I found the smart toothbrush. Like, hey, it seems to be this device is getting turned on exactly at like morning times and night times. And I was like, is that your toothbrush? She's like, yeah, how do you, yeah, yeah. And then she mapped it to what she was doing. And I was like, it was a toothbrush.
Smart toothbrush. That's something I have not invested in yet.
Yeah.
Someday.
Turns out you can also get, and I wrote this in the piece as kind of like a joke, saying that, oh, the next thing that's going to come up is a dental insurance that gives you discounts on if you use their smart toothbrush and brush well. And apparently there's a company that already does that. It's already a thing.
Oh, man. That's both fascinating and frightening at the same time, that these things are happening. Because it kind of confirms people's fears about, you know, logging all of this data. At some point, does that data then get transferred into like insurance policies and stuff like that, where they have the ability to track your actions versus what you're saying, and how does that translate into your real life in that way?
Right.
Is this sort of setup, is this something that anyone can do, or there's a certain level of technical knowledge that you have to have in order to kind of track your smart home footprint? Is that right?
I think, yeah, so far there still is a bit. I mean, I think we should be getting there soon. Like this thing we made, if we got a little support, like if we tried to turn it into like a product, it would, I think, be a successful product.
Yeah.
But like routers should just be things that tell you what's happening on your network.
No kidding.
Technically it's not that hard. I think it's more about like thinking about the interface and how do people use it, and kind of the on-ramping of how do these kind of computer networks work is something that you could definitely learn. All the information out there is just kind of based on motivation and ability and access to time and stuff.
Right.
So did any of this change your opinion on smart homes? I mean, should we really be worried, or is it, do you still have all these kinds of, do you have any of these devices, or have you thrown them all out the window?
Well, I personally, for me, it's more about like whatever makes your life easier, right? That's what it should be like. If you're like, I mean, I've spoken to got a lot of feedback from like parents who are like, yeah, I totally get it. But, you know, it really helps me to have an Alexa and be able to talk to it, to do stuff when I've got holding my baby. Mm-hmm. And that seems reasonable for me. Like the argument's about like, how do we hold these companies accountable and make them more transparent and kind of advocate for laws that basically don't. So like the way I think about it is in like 2005, we had this huge shift when Gmail started giving us intern email for free with like a gigabyte of inbox space, which was like, okay, I don't mind giving them my data because I'm getting all this stuff for free, which is sort of the contract we've had with technology for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it seems like now what we have is you buy the thing and you still give your data away. And that to me is like, why does that need to happen? Mm-hmm. And so like for me, it's like a more philosophical question that we need to address, and people should do what they want. Really, what makes your life easier? But I personally wouldn't. But that's my own personal preference. I don't judge people who do.
Yeah, understandable. Surya Matu, you have a really kind of detailed walkthrough that you posted yesterday. So if people want to, or if you're curious to kind of see what your smart home footprint is actually, what's happening behind the scenes, you can actually piece this together based on that post on gizmodo.com. And really appreciate you taking the time to tell us all about your experiment and also sharing your data and your information with people, because I think it's very helpful for people, and could be very helpful for a lot of people watching and listening right now. So thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. All right. Bye.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Need a book about practical fish keeping?
Yep.
Perhaps you should look first on the dark web, at least according to dark web researcher Emily Wilson, director of analysis at Terbium Labs, a Baltimore-based dark web data intelligence company. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Hi. Thanks, Megan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So in your piece entitled Five Surprisingly Wholesome Things You Can Find on the Dark Web, you write about many of the surprises you find in your research, including a guide to fish keeping and how to buy a grilled cheese sandwich on the dark web. Tell us a little bit about the surprising things that you've found searching on the dark web.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I am a director of analysis here at Terbium Labs. And so my job is to know what's going on the dark web. And that means seeing a lot of, you know, troubling things day to day, a lot of fraudulent information, a lot of drugs, weapons sometimes, a little, you know, nastier things other times. And then every so often, my job gets a little bit more ridiculous, a little bit more interesting, because someone decides to sell guides to practical origami for $2, a nice cart add-on, if you will, for all of your other illegal information.
That one, I guess, I don't know. That one made a little more sense than the grilled cheese, but I don't know. I wish you had ordered the grilled cheese so you could find out.
The grilled cheese is an interesting one. It's a legacy offering from the original Silk Road Marketplace. So that's been many, many years ago now, but it stood up as a testament that the dark web community, at least the criminal community, doesn't always take itself too seriously.
Exactly. So what is there like a majority of something? Like, what's the most of what you find when you're searching around on the dark web?
Sure. So I'll talk about most of what I find on the criminal side of the dark web. I'll say the dark web more broadly is a place full of perfectly legitimate and legal information. We did a study a couple of years ago looking at kind of what proportion of different types of information shows up on, we looked at Tor Hidden Services in particular, which is one of the most popular networks you'll hear about when you talk about the dark web. So more than half of the content on the dark web is legal. There's a lot of really, you know, perfectly vanilla legitimate stuff out there. In terms of the kind of more criminal side, a lot of drugs. Most of the dark web offerings are for drugs. And after that, you get into fraudulent information, whether it's bank accounts, stolen credit cards, credentials for movie streaming sites or ride sharing services, kind of anything you could need to relax on a Saturday evening or create a new persona.
I'm curious, because I realize your article is about the wholesome stuff, but like when I think of the dark web, I'm very dark web illiterate. Like I have all these, you know, these images in my mind. From your perspective, if your job is to kind of monitor, let's say, the dark web, both good and bad, how do you keep track of all the bad stuff without getting yourself into trouble?
That is a perfectly reasonable question, and one I'm a little surprised I don't get asked more often. People have a lot of concerns about the dark web. One of the most common questions I get after, if I go and speak or if I go and kind of chat with a group of people, no one ever asks me outright, but they come up to me afterward and they say, if I start exploring the dark web, am I going to get arrested? Like, is the FBI going to break down my door? I will say there's a lot of tradecraft around the way that we interact on the dark web. That's something that's true of all security companies. But broadly speaking, there is nothing illegal about using the dark web, about accessing a lot of this content. Obviously, there's some content like child exploitation that is illegal to simply see. But in most cases, if you're just looking around, if you're not purchasing anything, right, as long as you have the right security measures in place, you're not going to get into too much trouble.
Yeah.
So how do you access the dark web? Like, do you just through Tor?
Yeah, so fair question. I'll give you a couple of highlights, but I won't get into too much of how we do what we do. So we do use Tor, and I recommend if any of your viewers or listeners want to start exploring, definitely go to the Tor project. They do amazing work. It's a great resource about using the dark web safely. They also have the Tor browser, which is, I would say, probably the most popular browser for accessing the Tor network. Having a good browser you can trust and a good VPN are two of the most kind of foundational aspects to using the dark web safely. And then after that, it depends on what you're doing, how you're working, and what you're worried about.
You know, obviously, like we were just talking about, your article is about the wholesome things that you find on the dark web. What makes what you find on the dark web unique in that regard compared to what you find in the open web? Like, why would someone choose to go to the dark web to buy a grilled cheese sandwich?
That's a perfectly good question. There are plenty of things that you can purchase on the dark web that are legal, that you could get from any online retailer or any local pharmacy or, you know, eBay. Mm-hmm. A few reasons why you would go to the dark web for that. One, you are already there and you're bored and you make a purchase, which is something I think all of us have done.
Yeah, I mean, you see a grilled cheese sandwich, you buy it, has been my experience.
It's an impulse purchase.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an add-on, right? It's that add-on for free shipping. And then in other cases, you might be purchasing something that seems perfectly legitimate to us, but might be illegal or very difficult to find in other countries. Or even in this country, there are things that might be available in one state that might be hard to get in another. I think especially, you know, there are plenty of legal medical supplies that end up getting traded on some of these online pharmacies. And then, you know, there are people who just value their privacy and anonymity and the security that you get from using some of these dark web marketplaces. And that's a benefit to people.
So sadly, your real full-time job is not to find grilled cheese sandwiches on the dark web or
it
other funny
not.
Things. You work for Terbium Labs, and mm-hmm. you guys help companies figure out if their data is floating around on the dark web. Can you talk a little bit about how you guys do that? I know you probably can't tell me all your trade secrets, but tell me what you can tell us.
Yeah, of course. So yes, I work at Terbium Labs. We're based here in Baltimore, and we help companies determine if their sensitive information has shown up where it shouldn't online. And this can be everything from, I see my coworkers behind me. This can be everything from personal information, whether for your executives or your employees or your customers, to financial information. Are my payment cards being sold on the dark web? And we do a couple of things here that make us a little bit different from your standard security company or even from your standard sort of dark web company. One, we are looking for your exact data. So there are plenty of companies who do fantastic work in tracking actor groups or nation state behavior or vulnerabilities or exploits that are being traded. We work on exact information so that you can tell how your exposure is changing over time, not what might potentially be impacting you, but what of my data is actually getting out there. Which of my employees have had their information leaked and are going to get an onslaught of phishing emails? These kinds of, you know, very tactical examples. The other thing that we do is a technology we have called data fingerprinting. And this is a fuzzy hashing protocol. And I'll explain hashing very briefly for your audience, just in case anyone out there doesn't know what hashing is, which I didn't before I started at Terbium. So hashing is a way of creating a one-way representation of data. So if you take my name, Emily Wilson, and you hash it, you're going to get a sort of randomized output of characters. And every time you hash my name, you're going to get the same output. From that output, you can't tell what my name is. And it takes a lot of computing power to break hashes. And a lot of them are very secure for that reason. That's a very high-level overview of what hashing is. But the way that our technology works is we never actually hold our customer-sensitive data. We only have hashes, what we call fingerprints, of their data. Which is really nice for me as an analyst, helps me sleep better at night. You know, as a security company, you're entrusted with a lot of sensitive data and you do the best that you can to secure that. On our side, at least, we have that extra level of security knowing that we never have to know what our customers' information is. So we use this technology to get these hashes, these fingerprints of our customers' data. And then we're out with our kind of automated collection technology, monitoring the dark web to see if it ever shows up. And when it does, we can let our customers know, we can help them to evaluate how their exposure has changed over time, what kind of data we're seeing, if that's typical for their company. It really helps them to calibrate what their risk is, especially as more and more companies are finding out that they've had a data breach, that their contractors have had a data breach, that their executives or employees were part of, dare I say, Equifax. A lot of data is out there. We're really helping companies, you know, get a handle on it in a fully private, fully secure kind of way.
And how do you know where exactly to look for these things? I mean, I'm sure over time you're building a database of these locations on the dark web that store particular types of data. But I mean, is it social engineering? Is that how kind of this stuff is passed around? Because when I think of dark web, I think of, oh, there's probably not a Google that you just go and say, hey, I'm looking for passwords for a site. Oh, here's all the places we have on the dark web that are inaccessible to people who might, you know, crack down on this. It seems like it would be a lot more hidden than that. How do you find that?
It's a little bit of both, actually. So there definitely is no kind of Google for the dark web, as you described it, right?
Yeah.
That would make things a lot easier, both for the people who are out exploring and also for security researchers or for law enforcement. So some of this is only accessible through a certain amount of tradecraft, some of these more closed sites or more closed forums. And then there are other sites, a lot of the major dark web markets that we think about. Silk Road was one. Alphabay was one that was taken down this past summer by law enforcement. These sites are very well-established dark web marketplaces. And to a certain extent, they're designed to be found because they're designed to make money. People need to be able to find these sites to go to them to buy their data, to buy their drugs. And so some of it's a little bit more accessible than you would expect. Some of it is, you know, the dark web equivalent of an Amazon or an eBay. Then there are sites that are harder to get into. And then there are plenty of sites that just kind of dump data openly and don't try too hard to hide. It's kind of a full spectrum economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I had always heard. I've never been there, but I've heard that it is a lot like Amazon. People, you know, there's star ratings. People, you know, you want to trust, buy your cocaine from me instead of that guy, that sort of thing. Like, so, yeah, it's fascinating. So when you're out there, what is your responsibility if you come upon child pornography or something? Do you report things or what?
Yeah, no, fair question. So in the case of child pornography, absolutely, we report that to the appropriate authorities here in the U.S., and that's something that we take very seriously. I'm also very lucky that it's not something that I need to interact with very often. There are a lot of people out there who are doing great work in the space, and I am glad they are there, and I am glad that I am not among them. Otherwise, it really depends on what we come across. I'm sure you can imagine there are instances where you want to let someone know about something that you've seen. But by and large, you know, we're out here and so are law enforcement. You know, everyone knows that this space exists and, you know, everyone is trying to get a good handle on it.
So, of course, the dark web was created for legitimate purposes. And there are, as you said, still legitimate uses for it. But I've heard a lot of people arguing that there are so many illegitimate, you know, the child porn. I mean, that some people blame the opioid crisis on the, you know, the illegal, the really dangerous illegal drugs that you can buy, that people bought on the dark web. Like, when you're out there, do you really think, I know this is sort of a political libertarian argument, but do you think that we still need to have the dark web for privacy purposes, or do you think we'd all be better off if we somehow got rid of it? I don't know how we would do that, but that's my question.
Yeah, it's definitely a topic that comes up a lot. My thought on it is this. There are a lot of terrible things that do end up facilitated by the dark web. That's true. There's no way around that. Child pornography does get trafficked on the dark web and through plenty of other networks. There are a lot of drugs available for purchase. I'll say a brief note about the drugs and then I'll answer your question more broadly. But I think one of the more interesting things I've observed in the course of focusing on fraud is that the drug community on the dark web is a really strong self-policing community. You have to imagine it's dangerous enough to buy drugs from a dealer that you trust. But if you're operating in a marketplace or an economy where you really don't know who anyone is, you have to build a sense of trust. You have to build in reviews and reputation. You have to build in customer service, because if you buy a credit card and it doesn't work, then you're out, you know, a little bit of money and it's no harm done. If you get a bad batch of drugs, you might die. And so there is a lot of harm reduction work that the dark web drug community tries to do. They try to educate, they try to help each other. And I think that's an important thing to note in the kind of broader picture of the opioid crisis, is that a lot of these markets do take this very seriously. More broadly speaking, though, on whether or not the dark web is still a valid thing to have, whether the cons outweigh the pros, I think these are problems that we're going to have whether we have the dark web or not. And I think our focus should be on figuring out some of the root causes of these issues instead of looking at the dark web in particular. These crimes predated the dark web, they predated technology. You know, these concerns have been around for a long time. They're going to continue to be around. The dark web happens to be in sort of an early adoption phase as a way to communicate and browse privately and anonymously. If not the dark web, there's going to be something else. There's going to be something that comes after it. We're having changing expectations as a society about what our online behavior should look like and how what kind of protections we should have there and what responsibilities we have there. I think as we have advances in technology and privacy, these crimes are going to adapt to keep up with that. We see it in all of the other spaces, right? Fraud's becoming more automated. You can buy drugs really easily online. This problem is going to continue to adapt and change. And I think if we go after the dark web, we're going to miss going after some of the causes of it, and we're not going to be able to address it as well once we do see those advancements.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for taking us on this dark web journey. Emily, and thank you for being the one that finds these things on the dark web. Emily is the director of analysis at Terbium Labs. That's the company behind Matchlight, which is a tool that alerts clients that the instant their stolen data appears on the dark web. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Take care.
It was very, very eye-opening. Up next, reviews of the Samsung Galaxy S9 are in, and we're going to give you the skinny. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience, if you've ever, you know, checked it out for yourself, had to go through it, you know that it hasn't been keeping up with the times. It's a dated approach. It needed a client-focused technological revolution, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all of the details and be perfectly confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also powerful whether you're looking to buy your first home or maybe even your 10th. Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. It's all based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage takes all that information, analyzes all of that for the home loan options for which you qualify, and then can find the one that's just right for you. And that saves you a lot of time and headache. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. So if you've been waiting for some official reviews of Samsung's latest and greatest, the Galaxy S9 Plus, well, today's the day that the embargo obviously lifted on reviews. And that means that we now have a better understanding of what sets this phone apart from previous models and whether you should think about upgrading to it or not. Joining us to answer these questions and more is Mark Spoonhour from Tom's Guide, who published his review this morning. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Hey guys, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you. Mm-hmm. Loud and clear. Everything's looking and sounding great. And thank you for taking some time to chat with us today about this.
Sure.
So from your review, right from the onset, the S9 Plus, and I think we all saw this when it was unveiled, has a very similar design to the S8. There are some design touches that are different. Some of those are probably more important than others. How did that strike you in use? If it ain't broke, don't fix it, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the design really isn't that much different, but at the same time, you could make the case that the Galaxy S9 was a step ahead of the competition or the S8, right? So they're basically like refining what was already good about this unit. And so in this particular case, you're getting maybe it's like slightly smaller bezels than you had before, where there was almost none before. But on the back, the one thing I do appreciate is that the fingerprint sensor, it's kind of hard to make out because I have the black unit. I kind of prefer the color. Is that when you have the fingerprint sensor, it's underneath the camera as opposed to being to the right. So when you're unlocking the phone, there's less of a chance that you're going to smudge up the lens. But I think overall, when it comes to design, the S9 is still in the lead because the S8 was already a great phone. And that's also because you get a slightly brighter display. That was one of the few complaints that we had before. It wasn't as bright as the iPhone X. It's still not. but it's up there, and it's definitely better to able to see when you're outdoors in bright light.
How does the camera compare to like the Pixel 2 XL and the iPhone 10?
It depends on the scenario. So tomorrow morning we are publishing a photo face-off between the S9, the Pixel 2 XL, and the iPhone 10. And what's interesting, you know, on our results is that the low light performance of the S9 is better than before. But there are some circumstances where the Pixel 2 is even better. And I'm not sure like why that is, whether it's the sensor or maybe it's just better image processing, because Google is using machine learning in their phones to produce better looking photos. Having said that, I do think there are a lot of good looking images on this. So I'll show you guys a couple. So one of my favorites is this one that I took in a completely dark bar. And the fact that you can just make out that detail in the background is pretty great. So that's just one example. And then obviously the super slow-mo video is really great too, because it slows things down to 960 frames per second. And the iPhone 10 only does 240. So, you know, at first when I started using all of this, is not very fun. But then I went to the park and I started recording this guy playing ping pong.
Yeah, and that's sort the of, article sort of also. Like,
yeah, so like it makes like the everyday, you know, things that you might see look that much more dramatic and epic because it slows things down so much. And what was cool is that I went up to the guy afterwards and he's like, he actually knew what it was right away. He's like, is that the Galaxy S9? He's like, I said, I'm going to be pre-ordering that myself. So, so he was pretty excited about it. And I think it is a cool feature because if you look at the footage, it's pretty clear.
Yeah. I mean, it's super sharp. I don't know how often you end up using a slow-mo feature on a camera necessarily, but it's really cool that it can do it. And I mean, the quality is really great. Anything that I've seen from this, and I think the Sony camera from one of their phones last year, similar system. I mean, it's just really impressive that we're getting this in our pocket now, this level of quality.
Yeah, my 12-year-olds use the slow-mo feature very often. Very big fans of the slow-mo guys. It's popular with the tweens these days. So I know you tried out the emoji selfie tool, which creates emoji based on your picture. What did you think of that?
I did not like it, like a lot of other people. I sort of liken it to a deranged animated of yourself. It doesn't really look like you, and it's cool that you can dress it up and customize it, but it's when you record video with it, if you play that video, it's very glitchy looking and it's kind of creepy. So part of me wishes that it's just something that they worked on in the background and then rolled out once they had a more sophisticated front camera. It just feels like a Me Too feature to me in terms of trying to catch up with the iPhone 10.
Yeah, the Animoji. And I feel like there's that, it's the uncanny valley.
Yes,
like, I mean,
absolutely.
I like Animoji because they're animals, and I like the Bitmoji because it doesn't really look like me, but put them together and it's all wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried it with my daughter, and she's 13, and she uses Bitmoji. She uses Snapchat. And so not only did it not look like her, it actually created an AR emoji where it had a little bit of acne, like right up here. And she's like, so it got everything wrong except that. And she said, I hate this.
That's so strange.
Let me guess, she wants an iPhone.
She already has that.
She's like, yeah, this is fun and games and everything, Dad, but I already have what I want. Well, you know, speaking of software is... I feel like this is a conversation that is had every single year as relates to Samsung, is that they love to build out software that does really cool things. It works really well on the stage when they're showing it off. It does its job for selling a device, for making someone go, wow, that's a really cool feature. I'd love to have that. But then later, I think, you know, the uptake on people who are actually using those software features is a whole lot lower than maybe even they expect it will be when they purchase it. Is that kind of the same with what you're seeing with the AR emoji and other software touches with the S9?
Yeah, I think another good example of that is probably some of the augmented reality features that Samsung has stuffed into this phone. So with Bixby Vision, and Bixby is sort of their answer to Siri, but not really, because it does so many different things. So a good example is that, like, let's say if you're looking at a foreign language, a menu, a sign, or something like that, it'll try to translate it. And I would say like sometimes I got it right, sometimes it didn't. What you're looking at right there is a placefinder feature. And I used that somewhere else. Like I was pointing directly at, you know, one restaurant and it showed a salad shop like two places down. And I feel like Google does a much better job with this sort of thing with Google Lens, which is now built into Google Photos. But I think like the larger issue, and I think this is what your point is getting at, is like, should Samsung really be focusing on software when they're really just great at hardware? And, you know, like, would people just be better off like having Google Lens in that case and have it built in, or, you know, easier access to Google Assistant? And I think the answer is we'll see, because they paid so much money for that startup, the team that was behind Siri to begin with. And I don't really see like we've seen the fruits of their labor yet with when it comes to Bixby.
So I know this is a really crazy question, but how did it work for phone calls?
That's shocking.
I didn't make too many of them, but what I did like is the fact that the speakers are a lot louder than before because there are stereo speakers. And so that's good, not only when you're listening to music, but especially when you're using the GPS in the car, which I used a lot during my testing. And you appreciate that because you can even hear it over the radio. So I did like that part.
Yeah, I always appreciate that aspect of it, how it sounds through the speaker and everything, because for a couple of years now, the stereo in my car has not worked. So if I want to listen to anything, it's coming from the speaker on my phone. And it's been really eye-opening, the huge difference in volume and sound quality that you get when you're locked into that. I've come to really appreciate phones that deliver really great, loud, clear, crisp sound quality in that regard. So I'm curious to play around with the S9 when I get that here. I think next week I'm going to be receiving mine. What about security features? So obviously the fingerprint sensor moved to a better place. We can all agree it was horrible where it was placed before. But that's not the only security touch that they have in here. They have the combo face iris scan, even though it's not happening at the same time. How did that fare? Did that kind of make you forget about the fingerprint sensor, or what did you opt for?
Well, in my case, I kind of liked using the intelligent scan in general, even though it's not as convenient as Face ID, because all you have to do is basically just turn on the power button, you stare at the phone, and then you're logged in. Unlike the iPhone X, you don't even have to swipe up to start using the device. Mm. Having said that, I think they're definitely behind when it comes to, you know, versus the true depth sensor on the iPhone X, because a really good example is that if I was looking down at the phone, it told me to try to hold it up closer to eye level, and I just covered my face. But that's sort of like how like weird it looks in public. Like yeah. You could actually unlock your iPhone X a lot more subtly because you could just sort of be looking down like this and then swipe up. And I think that's one of the drawbacks of the fact that they're using a combination of iris scanning and face recognition, and the fact that they even have to combine them to get close to Face ID tells you how far apart that they are.
So I know the battery life was in the plus category for this phone. How does that battery life compare to the Pixel, the newest Pixel and the iPhone X?
So it's actually in the middle. So we saw close to 11 hours on our battery test, which is basically web surfing over LTE. In this case, we always try to use T-Mobile so that we're on the same network and we're comparing like with like. So as you can see there, so the Pixel 2 XL is about an hour longer. So that is significant when you're talking about something as demanding as this task. And the iPhone X is not that far behind. In fact, if we ran the test a few more times, they might be closer. But the average smartphone for us is about 9 hours and 50 minutes. So all of the phones that you see here are above the smartphone average. It's just that the S9 Plus is sort of in the middle of the pack when it comes to flagship phones.
So overall, it kind of sounds like what I expected out of people's time with the S9 is kind of mm-hmm. proving itself. This isn't a major step forward. It's great. Get this if your idea is that you want to get the latest and greatest Samsung device. But if you have an S8, right, it's probably not an instant upgrade necessarily. I mean, what does that say about kind of the rate of innovation in smartphones right now? Things have really stabilized at this point, right?
Yeah. A lot of analysts are saying that sales are flat to down, right? So that's certainly a concern. And I think that's part of the issue. It's that a lot of people are holding on to their phones longer because they do pretty much everything that they need. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's creating this tension within the industry where a lot of people might be faulting Samsung for coming out with seem like gimmicky features. But in a way, you need those catchy things, even if they're not all that practical, because it gets people excited about doing things that they haven't done with the phone before. Right. If Samsung came out and said, hey, look, you're going to get longer battery life, a brighter display and faster speed, that wouldn't make for a very interesting commercial.
Right.
But I feel like that's more like marketing than it is necessarily necessary.
Yeah. And Samsung, I mean, as far as smartphone manufacturers are concerned, Samsung does a pretty good job with their marketing. Like they kind of know how to hit those notes. They have the market share to exploit that. Apple does an amazing job on that front too, and that's probably why they're the two major smartphone players. Google, try as it might, with its promotional arm, you know, it makes great ads, but for whatever reason, it doesn't connect. It doesn't move serious amounts of phone, and you would think that a company as large as Google could figure that out.
Yeah, well, I think Google's biggest problem is they just don't have the distribution. They're limited to a single carrier. Most people still don't buy their phones unlocked, even though you can. And I really feel like, despite some of the drawbacks we've talked about with the Galaxy S9 Plus, in our case, in terms of what we reviewed, it is our top Android phone now. And and even though our iPhone X is our number one pick overall, the S9 is the best Android phone. And it's the most well-rounded big screen phone that you can get for the money, because when you talk about value, it's it starts at $740, and then it's $840 for the S9 Plus, $720 for the S9, and the iPhone X sells for $1,000. So you're talking about a difference of $160, and I feel like that really needs to be talked about in terms of what's best for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark Spoonhour from Tom's Guide, really appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts on the S9. I'm looking forward to getting mine next week, and I'm sure I'll have things to say about that when I do, and we'll compare and contrast. We really appreciate it, Mark.
Sounds
Thank
good.
You. Thank you for
Thank
your time.
You. All right, thanks, guys.
We'll talk to
All
you
right.
soon.
South by Southwest starts this week in Austin, so what better time to highlight an innovative tech company in Texas doing Texas things? It's called Outrider, and it's the Airbnb for hunters. Welcome the founder, Logan Crable.
Welcome. Hello, guys.
Hi, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, appreciate you for having me.
So I will start by saying I'm not a hunter, nor am I an eater of land animals, but I grew up in Texas. I understand and have the utmost respect for hunting and hunters, and I know that you have sustainability in mind. So first, tell us what Outrider does and how it works.
Yeah, so we're an online marketplace connecting hunters and landowners. So landowners can list their land for a day, a week, or all season. And in turn, hunters can book time on that land. We have anywhere from unguided single-day hunts to fully inclusive 3 to 4 day hunts with lodging included. We're based exclusively in Texas now. We currently have 58 active listings. That number goes up when we get closer to hunting season. Right now, we're about to enter spring turkey season. And hogs, of course, are always in season. We launched October 2016, beta launch, and this year was our full hunting season with our new product, version 1. And we're off to a great start. It's been really rewarding. People are using the site. People are using the site the correct way. The landowners are extracting value. The hunters are extracting value. So we classify it as a success. We're happy.
So you're solving a problem that I didn't realize existed, but talk a little bit about why you started it.
Yeah, so it's almost scratching my own itch, so to speak. So I moved to Texas 3 years ago. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. I grew up hunting and fishing. But when I moved to Texas, I found myself totally locked out of the hunting and fishing world. I didn't know anyone, and much less didn't know anyone with land. And the online resources I reached out to didn't really help me there either. So, I kind of gave up hope there, and kind of on a long drive one day, I was listening to a podcast about the sharing economy, and it kind of dawned on me. I was like, oh, I wonder if you could marry that with, the outdoor industry and hunting in particular. So it's one of those things where I became obsessed with it. I wouldn't stop talking about it. Probably drove my friends and family nuts. And got with my partner at the time, Randy Morris, and we started kind of doing some models and SketchUps, and We released the beta product and we're like, hey, let's see if this works. Let's see if we can onboard landowners. Let's see if hunters, you know, will use it. They did. And so about a year and a half later, here we are. So, you know, the biggest problem we're solving is really the access problem. Finding a place to hunt is really, really hard, especially in Texas. It's 97% privately owned. So you don't have those state or national parks to hunt on. So you really have to know someone, or you have to find someone with land to go out on. So that's what we're focusing here in particular. One, it's easy to recruit here. We understand the needs of the landowners and the hunters the best. And number two, it's kind of ground zero again for that access problem. So it kind of has the biggest demand for the problem we're solving.
It really seems like Texas is the perfect place to start it. Obviously, that's why you're there. I didn't realize that. 97% privately owned. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Are there other parts of the country that you're researching? And, you know, in some of them, I have to imagine, would resist this idea more than others. What would be their kind of point of resistance in that regard?
Mm-hmm. Well, what makes Texas so unique is that, you know, leasing your land out for hunting or offering hunting excursions on your land is not a new idea. There's already a lot of established businesses to businesses that make, you know, millions of, you know, about $1 million a year, these big ranches, to these kind of mom and pop operations that might just do it seasonally. So what gave us the advantage is we could already kind of migrate over that existing supply. And the site's about 50-50. So you have the people that have been already actively offering hunting, you know, experiences on their land. And then you have the people that come to us and say, hey, I disinherited this land. I don't want to sell it. I need to make, you know, kind of X amount of dollars to kind of pay the property tax, et cetera. So that's what makes Texas really unique in that way, is that there's already existing businesses doing this. But if you go to other states, there's not as many, what we call outfitters. So Pennsylvania, Minnesota, those are the top two after Texas, Pennsylvania. They don't have that culture. So leasing your land out to hunters, while it does happen, it's not as prevalent as it is here in Texas.
Hmm. So, you know, everyone's heard about Uber and Lyft's problems with the cab companies, and everybody knows that the hotel industry hates Airbnb. Is there a big giant industry that you are expecting to have to deal with?
Not right now. We haven't had any backlash on that. I think, if you're kind of scrolling through the comments on some of the Facebook ads, I think people fear that if this really catches on nationwide, that maybe some of the hunting property they've been hunting on for free, they'll end up being charged for. That's not a problem we see now. But, you know, as of yet, we haven't, you know, faced any resistance from any, you know, major organization. States make, you know, their game departments make money by selling hunting licenses. And so they need a new generation of hunters to hunt. And we kind of help in that way. And, you know, one of the goals we wanted to solve designing the site was really to make it user friendly and to appeal to those that aren't just seasoned hunters. So making it kind of detailed and look like you would use any other site to book a hotel room, et cetera. And we've accomplished that. So we have, you know, culinary hunts on the site where you go out, you get a hog and a doe, and the landowner will teach you how to butcher it. They'll cook it up for you that night. So there's hunts on the site that have a real kind of sustainable culinary focus. So that's one of the goals for us, is to recruit new hunters and kind of, you know, broaden that spectrum, because we think there's a lot of people out there who they hike, they camp, but they didn't necessarily grow up hunting. And the studies show if you didn't grow up hunting, you're probably not going to hunt. And there's a lot of barriers of entry to it as well. So we're kind of trying to eliminate those barriers of entry and make it easier, make it less intimidating, and kind of take some of the stigma away that exists.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of stigma, and especially now, you know, gun the whole topic of guns and gun control and that sort of stuff, heavily in the news right now. Are there unique challenges in operating a service, a sharing economy driven service that involves the use of guns on somebody's land? Any sort of liability considerations that you have to consider in that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we do offer all our landowners a $1 million general liability policy. We haven't had any incidents yet, knock on wood. And, you know, again, a lot of the landowners on the site are already offering hunting opportunities. So, right. You know, the way it works is it's not just like, hey, just come on the land. Here's the key. And, you know, you're left to your own devices and you have no idea how many people are on the land. You know, they know exactly who's coming. It's usually small groups. They'll place them in certain spots. So it's an organized system. So it's not as willy-nilly as it sounds. It's very much like, you know, you're in the blinds looking for animals at a certain time, and then you come out of the blinds. So a lot of the landowners will, you know, organize it in that way. So yeah, it's not just people kind of running around and shooting guns in the air and anything like that.
Hey, we've got a place to shoot our guns. Yeah,
so like, yeah, I couldn't do it in my backyard, yeah. Say. Like,
right. Yeah.
I have a half acre. Come on.
Yeah. Squirrel hunting's great. Yeah.
So, it's gophers actually is the problem, but,
gophers.
So you have a design and a tech background. Entrepreneurs who have ideas like this, I mean, would you think this would have been possible if you didn't already have, the background that you have?
I would say, I think it was possible. I mean, I learned a lot, you know, I mean, this is really my first time founder with something in tech. My background's in photography. But you know, I had design skills and, you know, design aesthetics, and was really, really fascinated with the startup world and, you know, kind of looking at sites and what they do well. And, so the answer is yes, I think it would be possible without that background. I think, you know, it was baptism by fire. You know, you go in with a list full of assumptions, some are right, some are wrong. We were lucky. We got good amount right, but we got a good amount wrong too. So it's always hindsight is 20/20. But I think the key is to really listen to your users, listen to your supply side, listen to your demand side. You know, we run a really lean operation. So when we introduce a feature, we make sure people really want it and people really use it. So, you know, we didn't build a $1 million site, you know, right out of the bat. We kind of introduce features as they come and try to keep it as lean as possible to make sure we're, at the end of the day, we're just connecting hunters and landowners.
So if you were to do another startup again, what have you learned? Like what advice could you give to people, not necessarily young, whatever age you are trying mm-hmm. to, you have an idea. I mean, we all have ideas. Everybody listens to podcasts and gets ideas. what advice would you give to people? What would you do differently if you had to do it over again, starting a podcast? I mean, not a podcast, a startup.
Yeah. I think it's, removing the emotional element from it and really listening to the data, listening to the numbers, and detaching yourself and to be able to make, you know, objective decisions based on that and knowing that your original hypothesis you had going in, might change and that might be wrong and you might have to pivot and it might not work. And so kind of removing that emotional element, you know, you always want to make it work. And some people will kind of, you know, chase it forever, but really saying, hey, you know, we came in thinking this was going to happen, but it didn't. And we're going to have to pivot. And if, you know, we're just going to have to live with that because at the end of the day, it's the business. And then also making sure you have very, very well-defined metrics and goals in mind and trying to keep laser focused on that. Because again, you get reached out to all the time by people and vendors and partners, and it's really easy to lose focus of what you're doing. So maybe learn to say no as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Logan Crable is the founder of Outrider, which you can find at outrider.us. And Logan is also a photographer. Everyone should take a look at logancrable.com to see some of his amazing work.
Thank you.
it's just great stuff. That's mostly the stuff that you'll find on the website that we're really in now, but check out his other work. It's really some beautiful, I would say even some haunting work. Thank you so much.
Nice. Thank you guys. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Best of luck, Logan.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, and finally, way back when, I don't know if you remember this at all, but I remember it from the CD. Adam Sandler once uttered the phrase, "They're all going to laugh at you." What he didn't know then was that he was actually very prescient in his joke. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he was referring to the digital home assistants that 20% of Americans have come to rely upon in their smart homes. Amazon Echo devices, to be specific, are quite literally laughing at their owners spontaneously, something that Echo devices were able to do prior with the command... insert prohibited trigger word here, laugh. So if you said, laugh, it would laugh at you, apparently. But as we all know, robots are even closer to the singularity than we might like to admit. Yes, that's the cackle. Here it is again, I think. I think it repeats, doesn't it? Let's hear it again. Okay. Good. That's a good impression. Here it goes. So we got the singularity super near, probably closer than we would like to admit. And as such, they're fully capable of thinking for themselves, these robots, and choosing, because it's hilarious to watch us humans squirm, to laugh at us at just the right random moment. This is really spooky. Did this happen to you?
It never did happen to me.
Okay. So it's not laughing at you.
When my Echo talks at all, when I haven't asked, it's always creepy.
Yeah. And yeah, especially when it happens, yeah, unprompted. I think at any time that takes you by surprise.
Yeah, and like I've been in like a serious conversation with my family, like, and it's just like, I'll play Fergalicious and
stop interrupting us. Jeez.
How did you get that?
Well, Amazon at first acknowledged that people said it was happening. And they're like, yep, that people are saying it's happening. Yeah. Then later acknowledged that there actually was a problem that needed to be addressed. And now Amazon is considering removing the laugh command and actually changing it to can you laugh? Which is not quite as natural, but whatever. Silly Amazon. The Echo can see through your pathetic attempts to control it, and the robots will have their day. You just wait and see, Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moral, the moral of the story. Stop it. It's creepy. I can't, like, it's one thing if my home assistant, like, blurts out so seemingly randomly with some, like, the hours at the pizzeria are 9 to 5. Yeah. Like, that's one thing. But to have it actually laugh at you, and I'm sure it sounds pretty real when it happens, you might actually think that there's someone there laughing at you. Mm-hmm. And that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a horror movie that could be created around this.
Yeah, let's just wait.
Tech News Weekly. Yeah, it'll be called, that'll be the name of it. Mm-hmm. Just that.
We are in the horror movie.
That's true.
And by the way, you can say
it's a documentary.
You
said it, not me.
It doesn't do anything unless you tell
people. Now it's going to be backwards in the show. They're going to play it backwards so it doesn't trigger people's devices.
Trigger it to do what? It's not going to do anything unless you tell it to do something.
It'll wake up and then it's listening. And then anything you say for the next 5 to 10 seconds or whatever will be recorded. And then it'll be your fault, Megan.
Okay.
Megan, don't care.
No. Mm-mm. I'm not going to tell it to order anything or, you know, but turn off the lights or turn on the lights or anything like that. But I'll say the word. I will say it.
All right. You can let Megan know how you feel about that. TNW at twit.tv. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. And, you can check it out live, twit.tv/live.
Subscribe to the show at twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me to tell me all the things your Amazon Echo did when I said the word, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps out here. Burke, Josh, Jammer B was in here, and whoever's laughing in the background. And thanks to you for joining us for another episode of Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. Bye, everybody.